Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today's Good Gardening with the Garden Guy, or we just saw say the Garden Guy Show. Gary, hey, we got Sue here, my sister Sue down in Kalamazoo. Welcome, Sue.
Oh, why, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. We have so many things to talk about, but we're going to talk about a little bit about maple sap and syrup, and we're going to talk about the weather, and we're going to talk have a pumpkin quiz. But, Gary, what's going on with the weather?
Well, do we want to have our prayer first?
Oh, we probably need to have a prayer. Gary, will you lead us in a word of prayer?
Our Heavenly Father, we again thank you for bringing us together to discuss gardening, and we thank you for the opportunity to learn through nature, and we pray that you'll bless this program today. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Amen. So, back to the question, what's up with the weather, and what does that have to do with our planting?
Well, I mean, it's Michigan. Come on, Tom.
Well, you know, I saw something. It was on a Facebook. It had to do with Groundhog's Day, okay?
Yeah, well, I don't worry too much about that groundhog.
Right, I got you. But it has two pictures. The first one, it says, I saw my shadow, so there's going to be six more weeks of winter.
Actually, we were supposed to have an earlier spring this year.
Okay.
Based on what went on with the groundhog. But most of the time when I see a groundhog, I want him out of my garden.
So. Oh, that's true. I don't
But
like...
they are good vegetarians.
But, oh, wait a minute. You didn't get the for the shoe to drop, okay? The second picture, all of a sudden the groundhog sticks out his hand. It looks like the shape of Michigan. And he says, except for the state of Michigan.
No, okay. Well, when we recorded this in February, we had temperatures of 73 degrees in Lansing on the 27th, I think it was. And the next day is 27. So I don't get excited. All I can say is when we have a strong El Nino like we have right now, we're going to get a lot of mild weather. And I just get a lot of more work done outside.
All right. Well, people have been talking about the weather, but probably by the time we air this, everybody say they'll forget about it. So
we could be under snow, but I'm betting on it's going to be warm and dry this spring.
You know, just a side
note. Does that mean more bugs for our gardens and
Not necessarily. But because it takes a lot for the winter to kill off the insects anyway.
Okay. Well, you know, I just want to share with you, I had a reason, you know, there's two lakes that are inside the city of Cadillac. There's Lake Cadillac and there's Lake Mitchell. And I'm driving the south end on that cold, I think it might have been down to 13 degrees, but the wind is gusting, the lake is frozen, and there was snow in the air, and there was snow blowing up, gusting up. It comes over that little bank on the road, Sunnyside Drive. I tell you what, it was whiteouts. I said they could have done a movie set of a blizzard just yesterday here in Cadillac. But
you know what I want to ask you?
What do you want to ask
Are you trying to avoid the quiz?
I think he was trying to gloss over that.
Okay, it's time for the quiz, folks.
All right, the first one is a gimme. Is pumpkin a fruit or a vegetable?
A fruit.
I will agree with my sister.
That's right, because remember, anything that is the result of pollination and fertilization is a fruit.
That's right.
And anything that is like stems, leaves, roots, those are considered vegetable. Also, how many seeds do you think a typical pumpkin has?
Wow.
And this is a multiple choice question.
Oh, wow.
300, 400, 500, 700.
I tell you what, all I know is that when we scraped them out there to make our pumpkin pie and our squash and all that other stuff, there was a whole lot.
300, 400, 500, 700.
I'm going to go with 500.
Tom?
I'm going to, Sue's always right, so I'm just going to go with her.
And that is the answer. Good job, Sue.
I mean, how many?
Thank
of course, you. There's going to be some variation, but around 500.
So my question is how many brothers agree with their younger sister?
I have to save up these occasions, you know, right now.
I get along with my younger sister pretty well.
Yeah, I do too.
All right, so next one is, once they sprout, how long do pumpkins take to reach maturity?
Whoa.
This is a range.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to say...
Now, remember, it's one of the later things ready
right,
in the garden.
I was starting with 90 days, and I was trying to figure out how far to bump it up. So
you hit the first number right on the money.
Okay, 90 to 110 days?
Close.
120.
Yeah,
that's right. Oh, boy.
Oh, that's a nice guess, Tom. I like it.
Yeah, Tom's making a comeback here.
That's right. This is my day. Pumpkins is my subject.
Well, let's see if we can get you this time. How many varieties of pumpkin are there?
Oh, that's a Sue question.
So many, because
I'll give you
there's
a range.
Different branches of the family.
Well, he's going to help us out.
I'll give you a range. Okay. 100, 200, 300, 400.
I'm going to go with 400.
You know, I'm just feeling like 400 today.
Well, you're feeling too generous.
Okay.
About 300.
Well,
although when I was doing research on this, there were some that only said about 150. Another one said about over 300. So, you know, I went with the higher number.
They probably confused a few of those with squash.
Yeah, maybe.
remember the adage. All pumpkins are squash, but not all squash are pumpkins.
That's right. A pumpkin is considered a winter squash.
You know, that was like in volleyball. I just set her up so she could slam that one.
Good job. Tom gets an assist. Okay, so the next one, the latest world record in the biggest pumpkin or biggest pumpkin gourd was in 2023. How much do you think it weighed?
I know this one.
Of course you do.
I do. Why do I know this? Because
Did you hack into my computer?
No. I saw a little snippet of a program. I didn't get to see the whole thing, but they had a little, like a documentary on these giant North Atlantic white or whatever they're called, pumpkins. Mm-hmm. And it was called The Lord of the Gourd. And it was really cool. And that weighed in at 2,700 and something or other pounds.
Exactly. 49 pounds. 2,749 pounds.
Hey,
that thing is over a ton.
I'm not going to lift it up.
That's more than a car.
Yes, it is. It is. There's some smaller cars that don't weigh that much. That's amazing. All right. This one is interesting. What parts of the pumpkin plant are edible? What parts?
Everything but the stem.
Actually, all parts are edible. Every single part. Now, we don't normally eat all the parts, but just remember that when things get rough.
Yeah.
That you can eat the skin, the stems, the leaves, the flowers. And one of the things that they mentioned, you can eat the flowers of pumpkins and squash raw if you want to. And then I thought this was interesting. He says, they're particularly tasty when lightly battered and fried. And I said, okay, that's a good way to destroy the health of something. But tell me anything that doesn't taste good battered and fried.
Okra is particularly one of them.
I
will even eat okra.
Delicacy.
But if it's made like Indians make it, you know, Indians from the Indian continent.
Yeah, yeah.
Fried okra is not bad from
India. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, give me some. Hey, you know, Sue is all about pumpkin flowers, aren't you, and eating them.
I did some research for them so they could try some of the great proposed chefy delicacy of fried squash blossoms, because they had lots of them, but they never did it.
No. I'm going to try throwing some pumpkin flowers this year into a salad and see what I think about it. Okay, next question. What percentage of Americans include pumpkin pie on their Thanksgiving menu?
73.5.
73.5. What do you say, Sue?
I would say 89.3.
You guys are really generous. It's 64%. And the other 36% like pecan or pecan, depending on how you say that.
Right.
Apple or sweet potato.
Oh, sweet potato.
Yeah, because I grew up eating sweet potato pie. I didn't even taste pumpkin pie until I was a teenager.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I actually think you should add those sweet potato pie to the pumpkin so you come up with a real number for...
Yeah, actually, we did that one year. We actually mixed pumpkin and sweet potato together to see what it tastes like.
You know, actually, the first time I had it, I was about the age that you had your first pumpkin pie. Mm-hmm. My grandfather did some service for somebody, and as a generous thing, they gave us a sweet potato pie, and we just raved over it. It's the first time we'd ever had it.
They tend to have a little denser texture than pumpkin. But I like them both. Okay, pumpkins are native to where?
They grew up in Central America.
That's right, Central America and Mexico. And originally they were small and bitter, but they were selectively bred by the Central Americans and Native Americans so that they'd be bigger, fleshier, and sweeter.
And they've done a good job.
Yeah, they did. Of course, you know, others got a hold of them and went further. So the natural breeding's been around for a long time. Okay, this is one I want to really know if Sue knows this one. We'll see. Pumpkins are carved for Halloween, a tradition brought to the U.S. The carving was brought to the U.S. by the Irish. They switched over to pumpkin, but what was their original vegetable that the Irish carved in their homeland?
Turnips.
Oh, my goodness, you're so good today. I guarantee you, next month is going to be tough.
Uh-oh, we're in for it, Sue.
All right.
Well,
that's very
know, it
good,
helps
Sue.
That I just recently, I'm reading this book, a series book called The History of Fruits.
Oh, my goodness.
And it has all, I mean, I haven't read all through, there's like three or four volumes, and I'm on volume two. So, but it has something about pumpkins in there.
I think you better finish the series before he gets to next month and asks us the quiz.
If you were on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you'd be really up there right now. Okay, the next one is, what are the top pumpkin-producing countries? Give me about the top five.
Of course it's China.
Yep, China.
China 7.
Yeah, I mean, anybody that has 8 billion, not 8 billion, but 1 point something billion people are going to be up there in production of a lot of stuff. All right, who do you think is next?
I think it'll probably be, when I think about, like, there's potato or pumpkin a lot in curries and stuff, so I'm going to say India.
I was going to say India.
Outstanding. Yes, India is correct. Number three.
Oh, third?
Yeah, number three and number four, they're currently fighting a war.
Oh, boy. You're talking about Russia and Ukraine.
Russia and Ukraine.
Wow, that was a good
In
issue.
That order. And then finally, the United States comes in fifth. But in the United States, we grow over 1.5 billion pounds of pumpkin in the United States. So what do you think the top five states are for producing pumpkin?
Wow, we're getting down to the granular level here.
Now we know, because this time, I bet would not. Tom, I bet you know this one if you think about where. Who does most of the canning of it?
Most of the canning. Boy, I'm
a company called Libby's.
Ah.
Now,
and
where are they?
Where is Libby's located?
And are they in Pennsylvania? They're out east, aren't they? Pennsylvania?
No.
Where?
You live there.
A little closer to home.
You're talking.
You live there.
You're talking about Wisconsin?
No, it's not Wisconsin.
Illinois.
Illinois, that's right. Illinois.
What
and
city?
They grow, we're going to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
They grow twice as many acres of pumpkins as all the other states. And there is, in Illinois, a city that considers themselves the pumpkin capital of the world. This is where Libby's is, who produces 85% of the world's canned pumpkin. And the name of the city is named after a salt.
Salt.
Salt. Like salt and pepper.
Think of that little girl in her umbrella trailing
Yeah, Morton.
That's right. And the raincoat.
Morton, Illinois. That's
I haven't been there. I'm just trying to think where that's.
And
at.
Why would you?
That's right. Because I wanted to get pumpkins.
Well, they lived in Illinois for a while, so. And he explored quite a lot. And Michigan's in that list too, I think.
Yeah, Michigan is. I forgot to finish that out. Illinois was number one. And then after Illinois was?
Probably California.
Indiana.
Oh, yeah.
Then California.
Indiana.
Then Michigan. Then Pennsylvania.
Well, I'm thinking about.
Sometimes they get a little bit of it.
I'm thinking about taking a pilgrimage to Morton, Illinois, for the pumpkins.
Okay.
Okay.
There's plenty of pumpkins in Michigan.
Hey, listen. I want to talk a little bit about sap and maple syrup.
Okay. Go ahead.
Do you do any of that?
No, I don't. I only have one sugar maple tree in my yard.
That would limit you.
That's not really worth tapping. But maple syrup is still, I should say the sap is still running. Normally you have about 6 weeks and it starts in the late winter when the temperatures are up above 32 during the day and they drop below 32 at night. And the stuff that's being collected is the xylem flow.
Okay.
Which is the upward flow. We have the xylem flow and then we have the phloem flow, which when the carbohydrates are made, they flow out to all parts of the plant to nourish it. Well, when the xylem, which is the water and the nutrients, come up, there's still some sugars in that material that's coming from the roots. Mm-hmm. And then that's what people boil down. And you need about 40 gallons of sap in order to get 1 gallon of syrup. And normally, we stop about mid-March, between the first and second week of mid-March, because after that, the sap flow becomes more bitter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people stop doing it. And if you don't know this, maple syrup is divided into four different categories.
Okay.
And so they grade it by color, and all of them are grade A, but the top one is the lightest. It's called golden. Then we have amber. Then we have dark, then we have very dark. And as you get darker, you get a more robust flavor.
Mm-hmm.
But the lighter material is said to be a little bit sweeter. Now, also, if you compare maple syrup with honey, especially if you're comparing it with the darker honey or darker maple syrup compared to honey, you get lower calories in the maple syrup, fewer carbohydrates, which puts it lower on the glycemic index. And the healthiest of the maple syrups would be the darker one because it has more antioxidants in it and a higher mineral content. Minerals would be things like iron and copper and cobalt and those types of things.
And we're going to talk about copper.
Yes, we are.
Yes.
That's our nutrient of the day.
Now, let's hear this myth debunked. Is it quite honest for them to say this is organic maple syrup, and I was trying to figure out how it would be unorganic
if you add anything to it?
Well, I mean, if you're just tapping the trees and then you're boiling it down and bottling it
naturally,
you consider that organic. But the other thing you have to think about is when something is being produced, if somebody sprayed anything around those trees, then it would not be considered organic. But you don't normally spray maple trees anyway. But if somebody did for some reason, or they were using weed control materials around the trees, then it would no longer be considered organic. But most people don't do that. I mean, I've never seen anybody putting chemicals around the trees unless they were just tapping trees in a subdivision or something in their yard and they were getting lawn care chemicals put on the lawn.
Yeah. And
I just wondered about that because they always charge so much more for the so-called organic products. But some of these things, like, you know, the mushrooms they grow to sell in the store, and they keep saying, oh, they're organic and they have a high price on it. But there's nothing that I can think of that you would commercially put on your fungi, you know. So I mean, it's going to be organic.
Well, it's not only what you put on it, because you're not probably putting anything on it. It's what kind of substrate are they growing it on? So,
well, usually it's like that, some of those duffs. In other words, it's not something, unless you're out picking in the wild and somebody, like you say, was strangely putting it on there.
Even if you were growing something organic and, say, a farmer sprayed something on their field and it drifted over onto your quote-unquote organic crop, it's no longer organic. I actually had a situation like that where an organic farmer was complaining about another farmer's drift. They had some kind of herbicide injury, and they would no longer be certified organic.
Right. Well, the last thing on the maple syrup side is I'm looking for an evaporator. So if anybody's got an evaporator, Tom wants a looking for it. So, hey, let's go to a break right now. And the next segment, we're going to talk about preparing for the new season that's coming up, and it's getting close. Stay tuned for Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Sue Majeur, Tom Majeur, and Gary Heilig, our subject matter expert. We'll be right back.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you, and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We've got Sue Majeur, Tom Majeur, and Gary Heilig. He's the guy that knows what's going on. Hey, Gary, we had a lot of fun with pumpkins this last section, and a lot of laughs. Can we have as many laughs when we're the next section? We're kind of talking about miscellaneous prepping for the new season.
Yeah, we were talking about pumpkins. I'm going to go home and ask my wife to make a pumpkin pie.
All right.
So this weekend I'm having pumpkin pie.
Well, maybe we should send
you... I could do it, but she usually makes the pies.
Maybe we can send you back some pumpkin that from our garden that's frozen.
Okay, so...
Oh, the Jaradale.
Yes, you'll love that. You've got to try that.
All right.
Stop on down.
So this is the time of year, especially since we don't have snow on the ground in most places, and the ground has been kind of dry.
This is kind of a dreary time. There's no leaves, and everything is kind of gray. But you say this is an opportunity.
Anytime I can get outside, I'm a happy little camper.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is the time to take your soil samples, especially if you haven't soil tested for about 3 years. And... if you say, for instance, in my garden, I have some grapes growing there, so I'll take a general soil sample, and the first thing will be vegetables that I'll put down. But you can also put secondary and third crops if you wanted to. So if you have other things growing in the garden, like say you had an area for flowers or whatever, and you could say my first crop is vegetables, my second crop is grapes, my third crop is flowers, because we like to put flowers along the western end of our garden. And that way I don't have to take three different soil samples. But if you have new fruit trees and you don't know what the nutrient status is in the ground, you might want to run a soil sample, or you have blueberries or strawberries or raspberries, any of those types of things. Also, in the case of flower beds, pretty soon the bulbs will be coming up, and you may need to fertilize those. But you won't know what to do unless you run a soil test.
Okay.
And then a lot of times people ask about ornamental trees, and about the only time I suggest you fertilize ornamental trees are, one, if they're fairly newly planted, or two, the plant has gone through a really rough year the previous year, like maybe it was totally defoliated by an insect or something like that, and some fertilizer could help to get it off to a good start this year. But otherwise, we normally would not just fertilize landscape trees.
What the takeaway that I got, it was when you mentioned blueberries, you take a soil sample and then fertilize accordingly?
Or? Yeah, and blueberries, for instance, they require specialty type of fertilizers. Right. Like they need acidifying forms of nitrogen, and they also need acidifying forms of potassium, like potassium sulfate as opposed to potassium chloride, or the other one would be potassium. All right, which one is it? I'm trying to remember which one it is. 2100. Ammonium sulfate is what it is. Mm-hmm. That's the source of nitrogen. So those are acidifying. They help lower the pH and keep the pH down, because when people are watering with just the water we pull out of the tap, it's usually either neutral or slightly high in pH. And so over the years, it'll slowly drive up the pH of your garden.
You know, it's not the season for this. We talk about soil samples, but I think I heard someone talking about taking samples of the plant and turning
leaf tissue. Yeah. Leaf tissue is done later in the year, usually around August. Mm-hmm. And what leaf tissue samples will tell you is if you are putting fertilizer on the soil, then they will look at the levels of those nutrients in the leaf tissue. And that will give you an idea of how effective your fertilization program is. And if you're still below the thresholds that they have, and they measure those thresholds in parts per million of the various nutrients, then they'll suggest you increase the fertilizer a little bit. And of course, if the levels are quite high, let's say you've been fertilizing for years, they might tell you to back off a little bit. Okay. Because you need to be right in that sweet spot, because putting on too much is not going to help you more. Actually, mm-hmm. Too much fertilizer can be a detriment to plants.
So we started out with cleaning out the beds. You have some days where it's snow-free, so you have access to it. What's your ideal temperature when you start working? When's too cold to clean out the garden?
Well, if you have long underwear, insulated boots, and I just bought some new gloves.
Heated gloves.
You heated gloves. Yeah, we talked about that. You can work out there when it's in the 20s and the teens. As long as you're warm, you're okay. But we're getting into the time when pretty soon the bulbs will start to come up. And what I like to do in my beds is I'll just take a weed whacker and cut down all the dead stuff and rake it out and either burn it or compost it. Well, once those bulbs start coming up, it's kind of hard to do that without doing damage. So as soon as you can get out there and clean up, ideally you would have done it last fall. But that's
life
not
happens.
Always, yeah, life happens. It's not always possible. And I'm still cleaning up the vegetable garden from last fall.
Well, you know, I had ornamental grass. I had a fairly aggressive ornamental grass. I actually took my hedge trimmer and cut it off at level.
Yeah, that works quite well. One of the things I used to do with, I had a large miscanthus plant, which was about 6 feet tall. I just would set it on fire. And it would burn right down to the ground, and it would come back every year.
You didn't have the fire department visit you?
No. It was a very tall and fast fire because it was dry, but it didn't spread. It went out pretty quickly. You have to be careful when you start fires in the spring, because everything is dry. Even when you look at pine trees and things, they look green, but they're quite dry, so they'll burn a lot faster if they get caught on fire. But I'm out in the country. I'm very careful about how I burn things, and I only burn in certain days, like if it's rain so that the grass is wet. And I usually either have a hose there or I'll have my lawnmower, because I can just mow over something and the blades will blow it out.
I never even thought about a lawnmower.
Yeah. And a lot of times what I'll do if I'm going to build a fire somewhere, I will cut the grass down really low so it can't move. So the only other way a fire would move is if it was launching embers up into the air. And you can control that by just the size of the fire. If you have a big, roaring, big fire, it can lift some pretty big stuff. And if it gets into the grass, it can be a problem. But just don't build a big fire.
So if you're doing some cleanup and you're thinking about burning it, those sounds like some excellent tips of mowing it first and having watering it down if you can. Have a hose available and have your lawnmower. Start the lawnmower before the fire gets out of control.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you get a fire that gets out of control and the fire department has come, you're going to pay for that.
So I've heard that.
You have to think about that. But what I traditionally do in my garden, I pull up all the old tomato plants and the mulch that we used and those types of things, and I pile it up. And I don't build big piles. I build really small piles. And then every time I'm cleaning out a part of the garden, I'm burning that stuff because I'm also burning up diseased plant tissue. Mm. And then once I'm finished with that, then I will turn the garden over. I may put a little nitrogen down first before I turn it over, tilling it. And if right now, farmers are out tilling organic matter under, and that exposes it to more bacteria, and the extra nitrogen in the soil will speed up that decomposition,
really?
Okay. Which can help to decrease the chances of disease.
I like that idea. I may think about
Gary?
It.
Gary?
Yes, ma'am.
Can we have some tips on, it's because this year has been so strange and it's winter, I feel like there's going to be, because of the time of the year it is, I keep thinking, oh, today feels like spring, but I know it can't be. You know, our hopes will be dashed again, you know, because you can't tell how mercurial the weather is. What are some good tips, especially in a year like this where things seem like they're out of order, to say, okay, it is, usually they say, okay, the last frost has passed, you know, Memorial Day or something like that. Well, I don't know if that's going to apply this year, so. What are some good tips?
Yeah, it probably will be the same. When you get to Memorial Day, you have about a 5% chance of a killing frost. The problem that you have in an El Nino year when it gets really warm early is things start to grow. And for instance, I'll use fruit tree flower buds. They'll start to advance a little faster than they should. But still, we can get cold weather because it is Michigan. So as things develop on those warm days and then you get a cold snap, you can get more damage than you normally would have if it had been a normal year, because the more developed the flower buds are, the higher the temperature they can be damaged at. Follow what I'm saying? Because they become more susceptible to injury as they're developing.
Yeah, they're further developed, so there's more chance of injury.
So we risk that type of situation. But there's no guarantee that that'll happen. But there are things that you can do to protect certain types of plants. But I wouldn't get all that excited about it. This Michigan. I mean, in Michigan, we can get frost like that even when we don't have a weird year like El Nino years. So I will be prepared for that, and I'll put heat where I need to put it.
Let's move on to transplanting. It seems early to think about transplanting. Are you talking about starting your seeds for transplanting?
Well, transplanting, I'm talking specifically trees.
Okay.
Because people will say, well, can I start planting trees now? Yeah, you could. Because the ground's not frozen, the trees that you would get would still be dormant. So you just get them in the ground. But if you are thinking about planting some trees, you want to be sure that you select a tree that you know you have the space for when it gets big. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people don't realize, there's this one tree I want to take a picture of. It's a concolor fir in a yard in South Lansing. It's huge. It's about 90 feet tall. It takes up the entire front yard.
Wow.
But I don't think they knew that it would get that big.
Well, we planted one in Lansing when we lived there, a little too close. I think it was 6 feet. It was
It was a conifer, like a spruce of some sort.
I remember planting it 6 feet away from the house. Bad choice.
Yeah. And then also you should look up, because when those trees get bigger, there'll be wires up there. And if, unless you want the power companies to trim them out, think about what kind of plants you're going to put in, because some plants have softer wood than others. And softwood trees, when we have these storms, can break a lot of branches. So try to select things that are a little bit more resistant to storm damage. Also, think about whether or not they're susceptible to insect problems like emerald ash borer or gypsy moth or some of those things that are still around.
So definitely the ash tree, but what other ones?
Well, oak, for instance, they're very susceptible to gypsy moth. So I wouldn't fill my yard up with oak trees, because even though they're not out of control now, but they tend to be cyclical. They'll go down for a while, then they'll come back. Also, another thing you want to think about is when the roots are moving out into the yard, if you're out in the country and you have a drain field, you don't want to be near that. And some people want to attract wildlife, and others don't want wildlife. Squirrels, chipmunks, birds of various types. And some plants are great for cover for animals, and others aren't. Like I have a dawn redwood, nothing will nest in it.
Why is that?
They just don't want to go there for some reason. I've never seen a nest in that tree, and I've seen nests all around it, and there are no insects and no diseases on that tree. So
Mixed blessing.
It is a mixed blessing because some people would not like it because it's what we call a deciduous conifer, which it drops all of its needles, and they're not easy to rake up because they're so small. Some people would be bothered by that, but they work their way into the soil, and not much of a problem there. You'd probably have to vacuum them up. And then, of course, certain things are going to need protection when they're young. Otherwise, deer will feed on them, and you might have to put a barrier around it or something like that. But no, it's not too early to start planting trees. The ground is sort of dry. You can dig in it easily. So this is a good time to plant if you have the trees. Also, it's time to start a lot of the vegetable and flower seeds because as we're into March, the end of April will give us 8 weeks, and we normally want to get things planted by Memorial Day. That would be 12 weeks from now. And there are some things like peppers that need 10 to 12 weeks to grow. So the things that take the longest, slowest things like begonias, they don't germinate very quickly. Those are types of things that you need to start right away. Others, you still have some time depending on how large you want them to be.
Literally, in my mind, March 19th is a must. March 12th, yeah. 19th.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to start sowing seeds right now. And one of the things, if you're not used to knowing when to do different things, note when you seed everything and then note how big it is when you transplant it. And then if you say, well, it's too small, go back a couple of weeks and then make a little diary of when you should start a particular flower or vegetable. And then you'll have your own little planting calendar.
It's interesting. I put dates. I do in flats. I plant in flats and I put a date on it. Mm-hmm. And that's stuck in my mind, March 19th.
And so, yeah, March 19th is about right because you have about 10 weeks before Memorial Day. So that's decent time to start things.
So you say pepper. What other vegetables should be done early?
Well, if you're going to start asparagus, for instance, from seed, you should get those in because they don't grow really fast. It takes a while for them. There are certain flower seeds, and you can read on the label for those. They'll tell you whether or not you need 6 to 8 weeks or 8 to 10 weeks. Something like zinnias and marigolds are on the shorter side. But a number of perennials, they take longer to germinate, and they're going to be 8 to 10 weeks.
On the list of talking points, the one that surprised me is sowing. Should you sow grass seed now? I wasn't even on my radar.
It usually isn't for most people, but realize that as soon as the temperatures start getting up around 40 degrees, grass is going to start to grow. And it's mainly the roots at first, but then as it warms up a little bit, you'll start to see the greening up of the plants. But if you have an area where you need to sow some grass seed, whether you're going to overseed or you have a dead patch that you need to seed, then as long as you don't have any grubs in the soil, you can seed it now and then put straw over it. As soon as the weather is warm enough, then it'll start to germinate. Plus the fact in the spring, we tend to have more rain. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to water as much. So even now in early March, it's not too early to seed unless, you know, we have a lot of snow or something like that, which is not impossible.
And you might want to, you know, if your snow plowing service has dug up a few things, do some repairs.
Yeah. Yeah, that happens once in a while.
Well, thank you. You listeners, this is Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig. He was with the Michigan State Extension Service, retired from that, but he'll never retire as long as he's able to grow.
No. As a matter of fact, on my way up here, I got a call from a person asking me if I do a series on small fruited camp meeting this year. So I said, yeah, I'll do it.
All right.
So if you want to learn how to grow strawberries and raspberries and grapes and blueberries, come to Michigan Camp Meeting this year.
That's right, at Cedar Lake, Michigan, east of Edmore. And Strong Tower Radio always has a booth there, so you can see us there. It's one of our stops every year. Well, folks, we'll go to a break, and afterwards we're going to talk about copper. So stay tuned. Copper is more important than you ever thought before.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
You're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, and this is Strong Tower Radio. It's the only place where you hear Good Growing for the Garden Guy. So you got to keep your dial here. So anyway, hey, listen, we're talking about copper. Copper.
Yeah, copper is our nutrient of the month, and it's one of eight essential micronutrients. And the macronutrients are the ones that are needed the most, like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Then we have secondary nutrients like calcium and magnesium. And then we have the micronutrients, the manganese and the molybdenum and copper and those types of things. And copper is needed for a lot of things. It's one of the things it can do. It can reduce diseases. And copper is used in various fungicides, especially effective against bacteria. And it's also used for seed set and also stress resistance. And it's very important for the formation of what we call viable pollen. In other words, pollen that will do its job. Non-viable pollen will not fertilize a flower. So you've probably heard me talk about that, where you have like certain apples are tetraploids, where they produce pollen that can't be used for anything. But copper plays a role in producing this viable pollen. And the way we get it, you can get it from fertilizers, you can get it from animal manures, you can get it from certain pesticides, which I already mentioned, because when you put on copper sulfate, for instance, for disease control, the plant can actually absorb some of that. And it's important in what form that it's in, whether it's absorbed very much or not. Also, copper is important for photosynthesis, which is the process where it makes the sugars, and the process of respiration, which most people couldn't care less about what that is. And it does other things too, but it's an essential nutrient because of that. And also, you've probably heard me talk about lignin before, mm-hmm. in that human cells are not hard, they're flexible, mm-hmm. whereas plant cells are firm, and that's because of lignin. And copper helps in the production of lignin and in the cell walls, which keeps the plant upright. So when you see a corn stalk, the reason why it's so stiff is because of the lignin in the cells.
So it doesn't have bones?
It doesn't have bones.
It has lignin.
Yeah, it has lignin. That's what helps holds it up. And the other thing, in terms of deficiencies with copper, normally we see it on organic soils more. Organic soils, or any soil that has more than 20% organic matter, or if you have a mineral soil where your organic matter level exceeds 8%, which most of us would think that's really great. And for the most part, it is. But for copper, it can present a problem because copper will bind with the organic matter more than any other nutrient.
So is that what ties it up?
It gets tied up in the soil.
I've heard that term before.
Yeah, when it says bound, it attaches to the organic matter, and it makes it more difficult for the plant to get it. And that's pH dependent too, because if you're in the right pH range, it's not as hard to get the copper as if it's out of the range for the plant. So now, as I mentioned, there are different sources, and normally we get it from copper sulfate, or if you're using something like a liquid fertilizer, you're getting it in what's called a chelated form. Because, as I mentioned earlier, copper is not absorbed as easily under certain conditions. And what they do to chelate it is they will mix the copper with an amino acid, which makes it more easily picked up by the plant. And they do that with other micronutrients, too. They chelate them so you can spray it on the leaves, and while those leaves are young, they can pick up more of those micronutrients. So now, the question is Michigan soil likely to be deficient in copper? Most likely not. Rarely do I see, and I don't know if I've ever seen a copper deficiency in all the years that I looked at plant samples that came into the office. Michigan soils are fortunate in that in this part of the country, we have a lot of minerals in our soil. In certain areas of the country, like the southeastern part of the United States, their mineral content's not as high, and you're more likely to see some of these deficiencies. So we're in pretty good shape, but I thought people should know about copper.
Absolutely.
You know, I wasn't thinking about it when you started talking about it being in this state, but I think Michigan is the one that had that ginormous nugget that was hundreds of pounds of solid copper.
Yeah.
And of course there was the Keweenaw mine and copper mines up there. So I got to thinking about that. I thought, yeah, we must have plenty of copper here.
Yeah, I saw a story about that. We were in the Upper Peninsula this summer doing a little prospecting, and I guess it was native copper, and it was sitting in the middle of a river. And it was just a huge piece. And finally some guy decided, I want that. And he hauled it off. And part of it is in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. right now.
Oh, it's still some of it around. I thought they had smelted it all.
No, it's a big chunk of it in the Smithsonian. Although I assume the Native Americans would have really liked to have that back. Because he just decided,
yeah, they probably
I'm going to take this. And it was heavy. It was really heavy. They drug it out of there.
So is there a native copper that is buried? We just don't know where it's at.
Michigan has been a big copper state for quite a while, and there's still copper.
The Native Americans mined it.
Yeah, when we
before
were
before we ever showed up.
Oh yeah, yeah. They used it. They used make copper pots and things. When we went into our hotel when we were prospecting up there, they had a box of native copper nuggets that you could just pick up. They're quite heavy too. Matter of fact, Tom, if you want to see them, I have them in my car still.
Okay, let's go look.
After the show.
Okay. So what's the difference between native copper and the other unnative copper?
Well, it's just talking about native copper is mainly chunks of copper that they find here in Michigan.
The other is trace amounts that have
to be smelted. Well, yeah, we have big globs of it in places. I mean, like that big piece that was just sitting in a river, and it was almost all copper. So that's basically what they're talking about is high concentrations of copper.
Well, let's talk about organic pesticides.
Well, as I've been trying to do is talk a little bit about organic pesticides and some of the in and outs of them each month. And this month we're talking about diatomaceous earth. And diatomaceous earth is made from the fossilized remains of diatoms, which are these little creatures that are found in the ocean, and their skeletons are made of silica. And the way it works is...
What do these things look like?
They look sort of like crystals. That's the best I could describe them. Or like little snowflakes. They're not all looking the same. They're all different. So you might want to look that up. They're very tiny too, extremely tiny.
Now, the soil that I find it, I usually see as black. Is that?
Well, no. These when they get them from sediments, and it's white.
Okay. Okay.
And when they grind it up. As I said, the way it works is when it comes into contact with the exoskeleton of an insect, it pulls the oil and water out of their exoskeleton. So it's a desiccating material. It dries them out.
Okay.
And also, because it's silica, it can have sharp edges. So if they're trying to walk across it, it can puncture their body too.
Isn't that like snails don't like it?
No, they don't. Slugs don't like
slugs,
it either.
Yeah.
So, no, they don't like it at all. And so it's effective against soft-bodied insects and the grubs of beetles, like you could sprinkle it on a leaf, and the Colorado potato beetle larva would not like walking across that stuff.
But the other stages are tolerant to it?
They would be more tolerant than the soft-bodied insects. Yeah, it would probably cause some trouble for them. But not as much as a soft-bodied insect.
You know, I use organic potato beetles fluid, liquid, and spray it on. Mm-hmm. Should I do a little
diatomaceous earth? No, there's a bacillus that works very well against Colorado potato beetles. And if you have the time, I mean, you can just find the eggs and crush them. I always tell people that you don't have to kill every one of them. It's just that you have to lose more than about 25% of the leaf structure or surface area before it's going to have any effect on the growing potatoes. So you can tolerate some. But a lot of gardeners, you know, they don't like that. It's like a bad mark, like letting an insect chew on your stuff. But I'm a little less...
More tolerant.
Yeah, I'm a little more tolerant. I just don't want them to get out of control. I'm willing to live and let live to a point. So anyway, the application can be made on the leaves, as I mentioned before, or it can be put on the soil. Like people will put a ring around the plant so that if you had some kind of a crawling insect that wanted to get on it, they couldn't cross that barrier.
You know, just think about aren't hostas kind of susceptible to slugs?
To slugs, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you may want to...
You could put some around the base of a hosta to make it a little bit more difficult, but... There are some negatives to using it.
Okay.
Once it's wet, it's not going to work very well anymore. So first rain, and that's it.
So one and done, huh?
Yeah, you're one and done. You'd have to reapply it. Also, if you're applying it to flowers, it's rough on pollinators because it'll have the same effect on them as it does on the other insects.
Also, so you want to keep it on the ground around there and not be sprinkling it on the leaves.
Right, and really, in my opinion, there are better products to use than diatomaceous earth. Plus the fact, it is a desiccant, so you would not want to inhale this stuff. And it is a dust, so if you were being careless with it and you got it in your nose, you're not going to be happy. It's not toxic to fish or birds, but if you have asthma, and dogs can have asthma, or any other respiratory problems, you would not want that around your pets. And it is not that expensive. It's about $20 to $30 for 10 pounds. So it's not that expensive. But I think there are better things out there, especially since I have asthma and I wouldn't want to fuss around with it.
Okay. Well, good. Well, we've drilled down through our list for the month. Is there something else?
There is something that March is a primary time for pruning.
Oh, yes.
And you should be out there, and that's what I'm doing right now. I'm pruning my fruit trees. And again, don't do the peaches, the cherries,
the
apricots, all the stone fruit
stone
plants.
Fruits.
Do those last. Right now, do your apples and pears. And if you want to do any grafting, for instance, one of the things that I want to do is I have a pear tree that I want to graft onto a bigger tree. And I'm going to try to put multiple varieties on this tree just for the fun of it.
Well, you've talked about that for some time.
So
now is the time to do it.
March and April is the time to get that done.
Is there going to be a YouTube video on that?
I don't know. We'll see. It depends. A lot of it depends on, remember I told you that pear tree had a lot of storm damage, right. And I'm going to have to see if it's going to work at all, because there was quite a bit of damage to that tree. I may end up having to take it out, so I'll have to prune that first and see what's left. So we'll have to wait and see. Also, you can also prune ornamental trees and ornamental shrubs. But remember, if something is blooming early in the spring, up to about June, the early June, then you will be sacrificing some flowers.
What about our lilacs?
Lilacs, you would be sacrificing some flowers if you prune now. We normally wait until after they finish blooming. But if you have a neglected one that's not blooming really well and you want to get it in shape, yeah, you could go ahead and do it.
Sounds good.
If you have something like red twig dogwoods and the twigs are no longer red, you can take your chainsaw and cut them right down to the ground and they'll start to come back. But don't forget to fertilize them, because you're doing a pretty drastic pruning, and you should start, assuming that the plant is still healthy, you should start having new growth coming up, and you can start to renew the new red branches coming up, as opposed to, you know, the woody grayish ones that you get as the plants get older.
Well, tell our listeners about your YouTube channel.
Well, I'm still doing the YouTube channel, and
how many episodes do you have?
Oh, I probably have somewhere around 150, somewhere around that. I hope to get to 200 by this year. So I plan on putting up the second version of my growing fruit trees at home. I'm doing an orchard management course, and I put up the first section already, and then I should be putting up the second one late spring. So that's coming up. And I'm also working on a series on growing strawberries, and I have a whole list of videos that I want to do that. Eventually, I like to do the same thing for raspberries, blueberries, grapes, but it's going to take some time.
Well, give the address of your YouTube channel.
You can just go to any of the search engines and type in Gary Heilig YouTube, and it'll get you there.
Gary Heilig YouTube.
And if you have ideas for videos you'd like to see, just email me at my last name, Heilig, at msu.edu, because I'm always looking for ideas. If somebody wants something special, I'll make it for them.
Absolutely. Well, Sue, we've had another fun episode. That quiz was a lot of fun this time for pumpkins, and we talked.
It was,
yes. So,
is there a reminder, Gary, that we should give to people, that because things might come out early? I mean, the snowdrops have been out in the fine display already, but things like lilies of the valleys and the daffodils. Those things that we love so much and smell so wonderful are quite poisonous, and you should keep them out of the hands of little ones and pets.
Hey, you just gave me an idea. I'll put something on to do with a future program, Poisonous Plants.
Very good. Well, folks, that wraps it up for the March Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. Until next time, good growing.